Hank. So would I, but I think it's better to just forget it. Just ignore her. Wanda. Your boss knows what she's like. Everyone does. Hank. That's true. He doesn't share her opinions of me, and she goes around saying everyone is incompetent but her. Wanda. That's bound to backfire. Hank. I hope so, or she'll give me an ulcer. Wanda. This is really stressing you out. I can understand why. Validating emotions. You know, she's given her husband one. Hank. He has an ulcer? Wanda. I just heard about it. Hank. Good Lord. Here are some sample scenarios to help you practice being supportive during your spouse's whining session. 1. Your wife's sister yelled at her for not yet repaying money she loaned her 2 months ago. Your wife is feeling outraged and hurt by your sister's attitude. She does owe her sister the money. Sample answer, I'm sorry she made you feel really hurt and angry. Or, poor baby. 2. Your husband got a speeding ticket on his way home. It was a speed trap, he yells. Everyone was going 80 miles an hour. Why do I have to be the one who gets pulled over? Sample answer, how outrageous. That's so unfair. Or, poor baby. 3. Your wife was late getting to a big job interview. Now she's worried she won't get the job. I can't believe how stupid I was, she moans. Sample answer, you aren't stupid. That could happen to anybody. Or, poor baby. 4. Your husband asked his boss for a raise and was turned down. He got angry and stormed out of his boss's office. Now he's worried that his boss will hold this against him. Sample answer, I understand how you feel. Or, poor baby. 1 last note. No one knows you better than your spouse. Sometimes advice may be just what you're looking for. The best strategy is to talk about what you'd each like from the other when you're feeling stressed. If your spouse is ranting about the promotion he didn't get, you can say something like, you're obviously really upset about this. How can I help you? Do you need me just to listen, or do you want me to help you brainstorm what to do next? If you have this sort of conversation every day, it can't help but benefit your marriage. You'll come away with the conviction that your partner is on your side. And that's one of the foundations of a long-lasting friendship. Once your marriage gets set at a more positive level, it will be harder to knock it off course. As beneficial as turning toward each other can be, it can feel hurtful and rejecting when your spouse does the opposite. Often couples turn away from each other, not out of malice, but out of mindlessness. They get distracted and start taking each other for granted. Realizing the importance of the little moments and paying more attention to them is enough to solve the problem in many cases. But sometimes there are deeper reasons why couples keep missing each other. For example, when one partner rebuffs the other, it could be a sign of hostility over some festering conflict. But I have found that when one spouse regularly feels the other just doesn't connect enough, often the cause is a disparity between their respective needs for intimacy and independence. Marriage is something of a dance. There are times when you feel drawn to your loved one, and times when you feel the need to pull back and replenish your sense of autonomy. There's a wide spectrum of normal needs in this area. Some people have a greater and more frequent need for connection, others for independence. A marriage can work even if people fall on opposite ends of this spectrum, as long as they are able to understand the reason for their feelings and respect their differences. If they don't, however, hurt feelings are likely to develop. If you feel like your spouse gives you the cold shoulder in little ways throughout the day, or if your spouse's concept of closeness feels more like suffocation to you, the best thing you can do for your marriage is to talk it out. Looking at these moments together will give you greater insight into each other and help you both learn how to give each other what you need. Exercise 3. What to do when your spouse doesn't turn toward you. If one of you is feeling rebuffed by the other lately, or overwhelmed by your spouse's need for closeness, you should both complete the next exercise and then share your answers. There is no answer key for these questions. They are merely a point of departure for discussions with your spouse. The bottom line of this approach is that there isn't one reality when a couple misses each other in little ways. There are 2 equally legitimate perspectives. Once you understand and acknowledge this, you'll find that reconnecting just comes naturally. During this week, I felt 1. Defensive. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 2. Hurt. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 3. Angry. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 4. Sad. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 5. Misunderstood. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 6. Criticized. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 7. Worried. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 8. Righteously indignant. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 9. Unappreciated. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 10. Unattractive. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 11. Disgusted. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 12. Disapproving. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 13. Like leaving. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 14. Like my opinions didn't matter. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 15. I had no idea what I was feeling. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 16. Lonely. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. What triggered these feelings? 1. I felt excluded. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 2. I was not important to my spouse. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 3. I felt cold toward my spouse. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 4. I definitely felt rejected. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 5. I was criticized. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 6. I felt no affection toward my partner. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 7. I felt that my partner was not attracted to me. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 8. My sense of dignity was being compromised. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 9. My partner was being domineering. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. 10. I could not persuade my partner at all. A great deal? Definitely. A little? Not at all. Now that you know what triggered this episode, it's time to see whether your emotional reaction is rooted in your past. Look over your answers to the Who Am I exercise in Chapter 3. See if you can find connections there between earlier traumas or behavior and the current situation. Use the following checklist to facilitate this search for links between the past and present. These recent feelings about my marriage come from check all that apply. The way I was treated in my family growing up. A previous relationship. Past injuries, hard times, or traumas I've suffered. My basic fears and insecurities. Things and events I have not yet resolved or put aside. Unrealized hopes I have. Ways other people treated me in the past. Things I have always thought about myself. Old nightmares or catastrophes I have worried about. After you've read each other's answers, you will, I hope, come to see that many of your differences are really not matters of fact. We are all complicated creatures whose actions and reactions are governed by a wide array of perceptions, thoughts, feelings, and memories. In other words, reality is subjective, which is why your partner's perspective on the past week may be different from yours without either of you being right or wrong about what really happened. In your notebook, write out a short description of your point of view. and then do the same for your partner's perspective. It's natural to make the fundamental error of assuming that distance and loneliness are all your partner's fault. In truth, they're nobody's fault. In order to break the pattern, you both need to admit playing some role, however slight at first, in creating the problem. To do that, listen to the following list and jot down all that apply to you and that may have contributed to the turning away or the feelings of being swamped and smothered recently. Do not try to do this until you have calmed down physiologically. Let go of thoughts that maintain distress, thoughts of feeling misunderstood, righteous indignation, or innocent victimhood. 1. I have been very stressed and irritable. Yes, definitely. Maybe a little. 2. I have not expressed much appreciation toward my spouse. Yes, definitely. Maybe a little. 3. I have been overly sensitive. Yes, definitely. Maybe a little. 4. I have been overly critical. Yes, definitely. Maybe a little. 5. I have not shared very much of my inner world. Yes, definitely. Maybe a little. 6. I have been depressed. Yes, definitely. Maybe a little. 7. I would say that I have a chip on my shoulder. Yes, definitely. Maybe a little. 8. I have not been very affectionate. Yes, definitely. Maybe a little. 9. I have not been a very good listener. Yes, definitely. Maybe a little. 10. I have been feeling like a martyr. Yes, definitely. Maybe a little. Overall, my contribution to this mess was, how can I make this better in the future? What one thing could my partner do next time to avoid this problem? As you work through these exercises, you'll become more adept at turning toward each other regularly, and the bond of camaraderie with your spouse will deepen. This more profound friendship will be a powerful shield against conflict. It may not forestall every argument, but it can prevent your differences of opinion from overwhelming your relationship. One of the ways friendship does this is by helping to balance the power between husband and wife. When you honor and respect each other, you're usually able to appreciate each other's point of view, even if you don't agree with it. When there's an imbalance of power, there's almost inevitably a great deal of marital distress. My next principle focuses on what can happen if one spouse is unwilling to share power with the other, and how to overcome this difficulty. Although power-mongering is more common in husbands, there are wives who have just as hard a time acceding to their spouse's wishes. So my fourth principle really applies to everybody. 6. Principle 4. Let your partner influence you. Jack was considering buying a used blue Honda. The car seemed like a great deal, since the seller, Phil, had only owned it for a month. The car was for sale because Phil's company was suddenly transferring him to London. Jack liked the car's handling and power, not to mention the state-of-the-art sound system. He was ready to do a deal, but first, he told Phil, he wanted a mechanic to check the car. "Why?" said Phil. "It's really a new car. It only has 300 miles, and you get the manufacturer's warranty." "True," said Jack, "but I promised my wife I wouldn't buy a car without having it inspected first." Phil gave Jack a withering look. "You let your wife tell you what to do about cars?" he asked. "Sure," said Jack. "Don't you?" "Well, no, I don't." "Didn't?" "I'm divorced," said Phil. "Well," Jack chuckled, "maybe that's why." Jack had the car checked by his mechanic, and it turned out that the rear bumper needed to be replaced, so he never bought Phil's car. But more importantly, he never bought Phil's attitude toward women. Jack has made his wife a partner in his decision-making. He respects and honors his wife and her opinions and feelings. He understands that for his marriage to thrive, he has to share the driver's seat. There was a time when Phil's macho attitude wasn't necessarily a liability for a husband. But our data suggests that this is no longer the case. In our long-term study of 130 newlywed couples, now in its 8th year, we have found that even in the first few months of marriage, men who allow their wives to influence them have happier marriages and are less likely to divorce than men who resist their wives' influence. Statistically speaking, when a man is not willing to share power with his partner, there is an 81% chance that his marriage will self-destruct. Obviously, It takes two to make or break a marriage, so we're not singling out men here. The point of this chapter is not to scold, bash, or insult men. It's certainly just as important for wives to treat their husbands with honor and respect. But my data indicate that the vast majority of wives, even in unstable marriages, already do that. This doesn't mean that they don't get angry or even contemptuous of their husbands. It just means that they let their husbands influence their decision-making by taking their opinions and feelings into account. But too often, men do not return the favor. "Anything you say, dear." That was the soundbite that some members of the media used, erroneously, to sum up my study on accepting influence. It was parodied on Saturday Night Live, pilloried by Rush Limbaugh, and picked on by Bill Maher, the host of Politically Incorrect. I got the biggest chuckle from one newspaper cartoon that depicted Saddam Hussein's wife asking him to take out the garbage and him refusing, until she held a machine gun to his head and he finally said, "Yes, dear." Our study didn't really find that men should give up all of their personal power and let their wives rule their lives. But we did find that the happiest, most stable marriages in the long run were those where the husband treated his wife with respect and did not resist power sharing and decision making with her. When the couple disagreed, these husbands actively searched for common ground rather than insisting on getting their way. To arrive at these findings, we looked intently at what happened when these newlyweds discussed an area of conflict, and also when they talked about the history of their romance. When we analyzed the data, we were struck by a significant gender difference. Although the wives would sometimes express anger or other negative emotions toward their husbands, they rarely responded to their husbands by increasing the negativity. Most of them either tried to tone it down or matched it. So if a husband said, "You're not listening to me," the wife would usually say something like, "Sorry, I'm listening now," a repair that tones down the negativity, or, "I'm finding it hard to listen to you," which matched her husband's anger but didn't go beyond it. But 65% of the men did not take either of these approaches. Instead, their response escalated their wives' negativity. They did this in a very specific way, by trotting out one of the four horsemen: criticism, contempt, defensiveness, or stonewalling. If the wife of one of these men said, "You're not listening to me," the husband would either ignore her, stonewall, be defensive, "Yes, I am," be critical, "I didn't listen because what you say never makes any sense," or be contemptuous, "Why waste my time?" Using one of the four horsemen to escalate a conflict is a telltale sign that a man is resisting his wife's influence. Rather than acknowledging his wife's feelings, this husband is using the four horsemen to drown her out, to obliterate her point of view. This is the opposite of accepting her influence. One way or another, this approach leads to instability in the marriage. Even if the husband doesn't react this way very often, there is an 81% chance that his marriage will be damaged. Although it is always important for both husband and wife to keep the four horsemen from taking over in times of conflict, it is especially important that men be aware of the danger to their marriage when they use one of them to escalate the negativity. For some reason, when a wife uses the four horsemen in the same manner, the marriage does not become more unstable. At this point, the data do not offer an explanation for this disparity. But we know that as a general rule, women do accept influence from their husbands, which may help to explain the gender difference in our findings. So although it certainly makes sense for both partners to avoid escalating conflicts in this way, the bottom line is that husbands put their marriage at added risk when they do. Signs of resistance. I've met enough angry husbands and sparred with enough angry radio talk show hosts to know that some men are quite upfront in their refusal to share power with their wives. Even in these days of gender equity, there are still husbands who simply refuse to consider any opinions their wives air, and never take their feelings or ideas into account when making decisions. Some men claim that religious conviction requires them to be in control of their marriages, and by extension, their wives. But there's no religion I know of that says a man should be a bully. I'm not advocating a particular spiritual belief system about the roles of men and women. Our research has included couples who believe the man should be the head of the family, as well as couples who hold egalitarian viewpoints. In both kinds of marriages, emotionally intelligent husbands have figured out the one big thing. how to convey honor and respect. All spiritual views of life are consistent with loving and honoring your spouse. And that's what accepting influence is all about. After all, do you really want to make decisions that leave your wife feeling disrespected? Is that really consistent with religious beliefs? It is not. This was brought home to me by a colleague, Dana Kerr, who is a Mormon bishop. Traditional Mormon doctrine exalts patriarchy. It holds that the husband should make all decisions for the family. But Kerr and his wife have an emotionally intelligent marriage. Kerr says he sees no conflict between his beliefs and accepting influence from his wife. He told me, "I wouldn't think about making a decision she disagreed with. That would be very disrespectful. We talk and talk about it till we both agree, and then I make the decision." Kerr intuitively realizes that a marriage can't work unless both partners honor and respect each other. That's true whatever your belief system. In many cases, I suspect, men who resist letting their wives influence them are not even aware of this tendency. There are men who consider themselves feminists who interact with their wives in ways that belie this label. Case in point, a hard-working software engineer named Chad. If you asked him in the abstract his view on gender roles, he'd come out squarely on the side of a 50-50 marriage. But that's not what was playing out in the new home into which he and his wife Martha just moved. One night he announced that he would have to work late that Thursday. Martha reminded him that her mother was coming to visit on Friday and that she was counting on him to help her clean the house and get the guest room ready. "I'm really upset with you," Martha said bluntly. "Don't you remember that my mother is coming? Why can't you shift your schedule around?" "Why didn't you remember I have this big project due? There's no way I can change my schedule. I have to work, maybe even the entire weekend," said Chad. His response upped the ante. First, he was defensive. Instead of responding to Martha's complaint, he volleyed back a complaint of his own. Why didn't she remember his schedule? Then he threatened her by suggesting that he would have to work even more than he had initially said. This was really a kind of belligerence. He goaded her in "here's mud in your eye" style. Martha became furious. She called him a lot of unfortunate names and stormed out of the room. Chad felt like he had just been victimized. After all, he had to work. As usual, her fury seemed to have come out of nowhere. His heart started racing and his head was pounding. He had become flooded, which made it difficult to think about the problem clearly or come up with a solution. All he wanted was to escape from his wife's unfair, irrational attitude. He certainly wasn't in the mood to find a compromise. So, feeling victimized, he poured himself a beer and turned on the TV. When Martha came back into the room wanting to talk, he simply ignored her. When she started to cry, he left the room and announced he was going to bed early. There's certainly plenty of blame to go around in this scene. Martha's harsh setup didn't exactly put Chad in the mood for compromise. But there is a history to Martha's reaction. Her mother lived in Canada, and she rarely got to see her. Martha had been planning this visit for a month and had talked to Chad on many occasions about how excited she was to show her mother their new house and to have her finally get to spend time with her two grandchildren. When Chad announced matter-of-factly that he would be working late, without even acknowledging the impact it would have on his mother-in-law's visit, it became clear to Martha that Chad didn't even remember that her mother was coming. Or if he did remember, it was such a low priority for him that he didn't consider his working to be in any way a crisis. He had arrived at his decision without discussing the problem with her first. Because Chad had a history of being in his own world, as Martha described it, she went ballistic as soon as he made his announcement. When a couple have an argument like this, there are so many accusations and counter-accusations that sometimes it can be hard to determine the underlying cause. In the case of Martha and Chad, though, there's a glaring clue that the fundamental problem is his unwillingness to be influenced by her. When she becomes negative, "I'm really upset with you," a straightforward complaint, he responds by escalating the conflict. In come belligerence and the third horseman, defensiveness. Martha becomes furious and Chad becomes flooded, which leads him to Stonewall, the fourth horseman. Their marriage has just taken a nasty tumble down the cascade toward divorce. Think of how differently Martha and Chad would be feeling if instead of getting defensive, Chad had apologized to Martha and acknowledged that he'd been feeling so overwhelmed at work that he really had forgotten about her mother's imminent visit. Or, if after this row, Chad had attempted some repair, Martha might still have been upset, but she wouldn't have felt devalued by Chad. If he had listened to her vent her anger without being defensive or belligerent, she might have calmed down. Then together, they could have come up with a solution to the problem. Accepting influence doesn't mean never expressing negative emotions toward your partner. Marriages can survive plenty of flashes of anger, complaints, even criticisms. Trying to suppress negative feelings in your spouse's presence wouldn't be good for your marriage or your blood pressure. The problem comes when even mild dissatisfaction on the wife's part is met by a barrage from her husband that instead of toning down or at the most matching her degree of negativity, yelling back, complaining, etc., goes beyond it. The wives of men who accept their influence are far less likely to be harsh with their husbands when broaching a difficult marital topic. This increases the odds their marriage will thrive. Any man who isn't sold on the need to accept his wife's influence more should consider the many pluses. Studies have shown that marriages where the husband resists sharing power are 4 times more likely to end or drone on unhappily than marriages where the husband does not resist. We see again and again that when the man shares power, the four horsemen aren't so prevalent. In large part, this is because his wife is far less likely to use a harsh startup when she's upset. Because she's not angered, frustrated, or humiliated by her husband, she is apt to begin difficult discussions without being critical or contemptuous. Another reason these marriages fare so well is that they have a firm foundation for compromising. After all, the better able you are to listen to what your spouse has to say and to consider her perspective respectfully, the more likely it is that you'll be able to come up with a solution or approach to a problem that satisfies you both. If your ears are closed to your spouse's needs, opinions, and values, compromise just doesn't have a chance. What husbands can learn from wives? Perhaps most importantly, when a husband accepts his wife's influence, his open attitude also heightens the positive in his relationship by strengthening his friendship with his wife. This will make it far easier for him to follow the first 3 principles, deepening his love map, bolstering fondness and admiration, and turning toward his wife as a matter of course. This occurs not just because the absence of frequent power struggles makes the marriage more pleasurable, but because such a husband is open to learning from his wife. And there's no doubt that women have plenty to teach men about friendship. In his book, The Complete Book of Guys, Dave Barry writes about the huge gap between men and women in this regard. He recounts that every year he and his wife get together with some old friends. The wives immediately begin an intense catching-up conversation about their inner feelings. He and the other husband watch the playoffs. The men do get emotional at times, usually when deciding which kind of pizza to order. Later, when the couples have parted company, Barry's wife will say something like, "Isn't it amazing how well George has adjusted to having his leg amputated?" And Barry will pretend that of course he had noticed George was missing a leg. Barry is exaggerating, but the story is funny because it reveals a basic truth. Women are more oriented toward discussing and understanding feelings than are men. I'm not suggesting that all women are savvier about emotions and have better people skills than all men. There are plenty of women who are tone-deaf to social nuances and insensitive to others. But usually, women are more emotionally intelligent than their husbands for one simple reason. They've had an enormous head start in acquiring these skills. Observe children at any playground, and you'll see that head start in action. When young boys play, usually run-and-chase games, their priority is the game itself, not their relationship with each other and their feelings. But for little girls, feelings are paramount. A cry of, "I'm not your friend anymore," will stop a game cold. Whether it starts up again will depend on whether the girls make up. Even when a boy and girl play with the same toy, the gender difference is apparent. When 4-year-old best friends Naomi and Eric shared her baby doll, she wanted to play that the doll was their baby and they were going to show it off to their friends. Relationship-based play. He went along with this for about 10 minutes, and then the game roller-coasted into boy territory. Hey, Naomi, this baby is dead, he announced. We have to get it to the hospital right away. He climbed into a pretend ambulance and away he went. Brrr! Naomi urged him not to drive too fast. Suddenly, they both became surgeons and saved the baby's life. Eric wanted Naomi to be the nurse, but she objected that girls can be surgeons too. So some things have changed. After the baby's life was saved, they went back to playing Naomi's way, showing off the baby to friends. The play styles of Naomi and Eric are equally charming and delightful. But the plain truth is that girlish games offer far better preparation for marriage and family life because they focus on relationships. As a general rule, boys don't even include games with relationship and domestic themes in their repertoire. Think about it. While no preschool dress-up corner would be complete without bridal costumes, you never see tuxedos for little pretend grooms. Where does this difference in playstyles between boys and girls originate? Because it occurs in virtually every culture, I suspect that it is caused mostly by biology rather than by socialization. But whether nature or nurture is the cause of these differences, their effect is undeniable. Because their play emphasizes social interactions and feelings, girls undergo an extensive education into emotions by childhood's end. Boys learn how to pitch overhand. A boy's experience at playing cooperatively and quickly resolving conflicts will be an asset later in the boardroom or on the construction site. But it will be a liability in marriage if it comes at the expense of understanding the emotions behind his wife's perspectives. This difference in training is heightened by the fact that as they get older, boys rarely play with girls, so they miss the chance to learn from them. Although about 35% of preschool best friendships are between boys and girls, like Naomi and Eric, by age 7, that percentage plummets to virtually 0%. From then till puberty, the sexes will have little or nothing to do with each other. This is a worldwide phenomenon. Many explanations have been given for this voluntary segregation. One intriguing theory by psychologist Eleanor McAvey, Ph.D. at Stanford University, dovetails with my findings on accepting influence. She found that even at very young ages, 1.5 years, boys will accept influence only from other boys when they play, whereas girls accept influence equally from girls or boys. At around ages 5 to 7, girls become fed up with this state of affairs and stop wanting to play with boys. From that age until puberty, our culture, and virtually all others, offers no formal structure for ensuring that boys and girls continue to interact. By the time Naomi and Eric are grown, the difference in their knowledge of homemaking will be apparent. Once a couple move in together or get engaged, the groom-to-be is suddenly immersed in what is probably an alien world. In the Broadway play In Defense of the Caveman, a man says that when he was first married, he saw his wife cleaning the bathroom and asked her, "Are we moving?" In his bachelor days, that was the only time he and his roommates bothered to clean the bathroom. Many young husbands discover they have a lot to learn from their wives about maintaining a home. You can see the shell-shocked look on the face of the typical young fiancé in any home furnishing store. He neither knows nor cares about the difference between taffeta and chintz. All of the china and silver patterns look remarkably alike to him. Most of all, he's thinking that this is taking an awfully long time, and if he turns around suddenly, he'll do about $10,000 worth of damage since all of the shelves are made of glass and placed about 2 feet apart, probably just to intimidate guys like him. How will he react? If pretty soon he hears himself saying, "Hey, that's a great pattern," another emotionally intelligent husband has been born. Emotionally intelligent husbands. My data on newlywed couples indicate that more husbands are being transformed in this way. About 35% of the men we've studied fall into this category. Research from previous decades suggests the number used to be much lower. Because this type of husband honors and respects his wife, he will be open to learning more about emotions from her. He will come to understand her world and those of his children and friends. He may not emote in the same way that his wife does, but he will learn how to better connect with her emotionally. As he does so, he'll make choices that show he honors her. When he's watching the football game and she needs to talk, He'll turn off the TV and listen. He is choosing us over me. I believe the emotionally intelligent husband is the next step in social evolution. This doesn't mean that he is superior to other men in personality, upbringing, or moral fiber. He has simply figured out something very important about being married that the others haven't. Yet. And that is how to honor his wife and convey his respect to her. It is really that elementary. The new husband is likely to make his career less of a priority than his family life because his definition of success has been revised. Unlike husbands before him, he naturally incorporates the first three principles into his daily life. He makes a detailed map of his wife's world. He keeps in touch with his admiration and fondness for her, and he communicates it by turning toward her in his daily actions. This benefits not only his marriage, but his children as well. Research shows that a husband who can accept influence from his wife also tends to be an outstanding father. He is familiar with his children's world and knows all about their friends and their fears. Because he is not afraid of emotions, he teaches his children to respect their own feelings and themselves. He turns off the football game for them, too, because he wants them to remember him as having had time for them. This new type of husband and father leads a meaningful and rich life. Having a happy family base makes it possible for him to create and work effectively. Because he is so connected to his wife, she will come to him not only when she is troubled, but when she is delighted. When the city awakens to a beautiful, fresh snowstorm, his children will come running for him to see it. The people who matter most to him will care about him when he lives and mourn him when he dies. The other kind of husband and father is a very sad story. He responds to the loss of male entitlement with righteous indignation, or he feels like an innocent victim. He may become more authoritarian or withdraw into a lonely shell, protecting what little he has left. He does not give others very much honor and respect because he is engaged in a search for the honor and respect he thinks is his due. He will not accept his wife's influence because he fears any further loss of power. And because he will not accept influence, he will not have very much influence. The consequence is that no one will much care about him when he lives, nor mourn him when he dies. The change is here. Although there are men in traditional marriages who are masters at accepting influence from their wives, the reality is that sharing marital power is a relatively new concept and has come about in the wake of vast social changes over the past few decades. Wearing the pants was once the norm for a husband, but times have changed. Maybe all of this sounds like a feminist line, but it's also the reality. With more than 60% of married women working, the male's role as the sole breadwinner is on the wane. Increasingly, women's jobs provide them with a source not only of income and economic power, but of self-esteem as well. A significant number of the core issues we see between couples today have to do with this change in gender roles. Often, wives complain that men still aren't doing their fair share of domestic chores and child care. This is not just an issue for young couples. We have seen the same pattern among couples in their 40s and 60s. Men who are willing to accept influence are happily married. Those who are not see their marriages become unstable. As one unhappy husband put it, "I married June Cleaver and she turned into Murphy Brown. It's not fair. I didn't bargain for this." It's understandable that some men have problems with the shift in the husband's role. For centuries, men were expected to be in charge of their families. That sense of responsibility and entitlement gets passed down from father to son in so many subtle ways that revising the husband's role can be a challenge for many men. Some men may resist being influenced by their wives because they still believe that the upheaval in gender roles is a passing fad, or that the pendulum is swung to an extreme and soon things will revert. But there is scientific evidence that we are living through a cultural transformation that will not come undone. Anthropologist Peggy Sande, Ph.D., a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, has devoted her career to studying and comparing hunter-gatherer cultures all over the world. On the surface, our lives may seem very different from those of the people she studies, but human nature is fundamentally the same. Sanday has identified certain factors that determine whether a culture will be male-dominant or egalitarian. Interestingly, no cultures were female-dominant. She has also studied the signs that a culture is moving in one direction or the other. According to her research, male-dominated societies are characterized by the following. 1. Food is quite scarce and daily life is hard. Danger lurks in the environment. 2. Meat from large game animals is almost always more valued than other foods. Hunting large game is almost always an entirely male activity. 3. Men do not participate in the care and raising of infants. They may care for children, but not for babies. 4. There is limited female representation in the culture's sacred symbols, especially in its creation myths. Sanday found that the cultures in which these factors were the most extreme were also the most male-dominant. And when these factors moved in the opposite direction, the culture also shifted to an egalitarian mode where men and women shared power. I believe you can see such a change happening in our culture today. Consider. 1. Food is plentiful and environmental conditions are not very harsh. Enforced laws keep the bulk of people feeling relatively safe. 2. Men are no longer the sole breadwinners or hunters for food. 3. Many men now want to participate in the care and raising of infants. There has been an explosion in the number of men who attend childbirth classes with their wives, are present at the birth of their children, and share in the diapering, feeding, and bathing of their babies. Go to the park on Sunday, and you're likely to see young fathers carrying snugglies and pushing strollers. Many women feel that men still don't do enough caretaking of the very young, but it's clear there's been a shift in attitude. 4. There is an increasingly strong female representation in our culture's sacred symbols. Catholicism has seen an important growth in worship involving Mary, the Mother of Christ. Not only has worship increasingly involved Mary, but her role has shifted dramatically from being the passive recipient of the Holy Spirit to being a woman who bravely and actively chooses to accept the role of mother in her encounter with the angel Gabriel. Luke chapter 1, verses 26 through 38. She intercedes on behalf of supplicants with love, compassion, and understanding. In Judaism, the conservative and reform movements have rewritten prayer books to emphasize the female in the sacred. The importance of the matriarchs is recognized, as well as the Shekhinah, the female qualities of God: forgiveness, compassion, understanding, and love. True, not all marriages have become more egalitarian. Many men are still disengaged from family life, yet a growing number are seeking guidance in coping with the cultural change. Witness the growing popularity of organized men's movements, such as the Promise Keepers, the Robert Bly Mythopoetic Movement, the Million Man March, and the Men's Rights Movement. People are now marching on Washington not to demand political change, but to make new vows about their role in families. Whatever your opinion of each of these groups, their very existence is a symptom of the seismic shift in social relations that has left many men lost and befuddled. The challenge for each man is to decide how to deal with this great transformation. Our research clearly indicates that the only effective approach is to embrace the change, rather than to react with anger and hostility. Time and again, we can separate the happy from the unstable couples based on whether the husband is willing to accept influence from his wife. Learning to yield. Perhaps the fundamental difference between these two kinds of husbands is that the new husband has learned that often in life, he needs to yield in order to win. When you drive through any modern city, you encounter frustrating bottlenecks and unexpected barricades that block your normal and rightful passage. You can take one of two approaches to these impossible situations. One is to stop, become righteously indignant, and insist that the offending obstacle move. The other is to drive around it. The first approach will eventually earn you a heart attack. The second approach, which I call yielding to win, will get you home. The classic example of a husband yielding to win concerns the ubiquitous toilet seat issue. The typical woman gets irritated when her husband leaves the toilet seat up, even though it only takes her a millisecond to put it down herself. For many women, a raised toilet seat is symbolic of the male's sense of entitlement. So a man can score major points with his wife just by putting the seat down. The wise husband smiles at how smart he is as he drops the lid. Accepting influence is an attitude, but it's also a skill that you can hone if you pay attention to how you relate with your spouse. In your day-to-day life, this means working on the first three principles by following the advice and exercises in chapters 3, 4, and 5. And when you have a conflict, the key is to be willing to compromise. You do this by searching through your partner's request for something you can relinquish. For example, Chad, who infuriated Martha by working late when her mother was due to visit, might not be able to compromise on working more than usual, but perhaps he could switch the timing of his work. He could, for example, postpone the late night until Friday, so that at least he could help Martha get the house ready for her mother's visit. Perhaps she, Grandma, and little sister could take their son to soccer practice on Saturday, traditionally his task, so that he could get some work done then. If, despite plenty of effort, a man is still unable to accept influence from his wife on a particular issue, it's a sign that an unacknowledged, unsolvable problem is stymieing his attempts. In such a case, the key is to learn how to cope with the unsolvable problem using the advice in Chapter 10. One couple we studied, Tim and Kara, faced this dilemma. They constantly argued about his friend Buddy, who Kara thought was anything but a pal. Unemployed, he often fought with his live-in girlfriend and ended up boozing and then crashing on their living room sofa. Kara feared that Buddy would be a bad influence on Tim and saw his frequent presence in their home as an invasion and a threat. But whenever she tried to talk to Tim about it, he insisted that this was his home and that he could invite over anyone he wanted. When she disagreed with him, he would stonewall, which made her so angry she would start yelling. Then he would accuse her of being the one with the problem, not Buddy. Kara was infuriated by Tim's attitude. As she saw it, he refused to respect that this was her home too, and that he had to share decisions about house guests with her. More than 80% of the time, it's the wife who brings up sticky marital issues, while the husband tries to avoid discussing them. This isn't a symptom of a troubled marriage. It's true in most happy marriages as well. When I interviewed Tim and Kara, Tim's unwillingness to accept influence from Kara seemed to be the core of their problem, especially since he admitted that he saw no grounds for compromise on the issue. Then I asked him what his friendship with Buddy meant to him. It turned out there was more to the story. Tim explained that he and Buddy had been pals since childhood. During high school, when Tim's parents were going through a bitter divorce and his home life was coming apart, Tim spent countless nights on Buddy's couch. He believed it was now his responsibility to help out the friend who had helped him. He felt that Kara was trying to get him to abandon Buddy. Doing so would go against his sense of honor. He wasn't concerned that Buddy would be a bad influence. He saw himself as a stable, married man and took pride in his ability to help his friend. The more Tim talked about Buddy, the clearer it became that he and Kara were grappling with a perpetual problem in their relationship about their views of friendship and loyalty. By recognizing that and working on the problem together, the issue was transformed. Tim stopped thinking about it in the context of his right to do what he wanted in his own home. Kara acknowledged that it had been Tim's piggish attitude, not just Buddy's presence, that was making her so angry. She told him that she really admired his loyalty. It was one of the things she loved about him. She just worried that Buddy was taking advantage of him. He acknowledged that Buddy could be a user. By identifying the issue for what it was, a perpetual problem, and agreeing to work on it with Kara, Tim had effectively accepted her influence. They each became better able to see the other's perspective. In the end, they agreed that Buddy could continue to use their living room as a crash pad, but less frequently than before. It took getting to the heart of a perpetual problem before Tim was able to accept influence from his wife. But in most cases, the key is just for the husband to be open to sharing power with his wife, then to get plenty of practice doing so. A husband can start by taking the quiz which follows. It will give you a sense of how skilled you currently are at accepting your wife's influence. There's no reason why wives shouldn't take the quiz as well, since the more open to influence you both are, the smoother your marriage will be. Then work through the fun exercises that follow. They will help you hone your ability to share power. Accepting Influence Questionnaire. Listen to each statement and mark down whether it's true or false. 1. I am really interested in my spouse's opinions on our basic issues. 2. I usually learn a lot from my spouse, even when we disagree. 3. I want my partner to feel that what he or she says really counts with me. 4. I generally want my spouse to feel influential in this marriage. 5. I can listen to my partner, but only up to a point. 6. My partner has a lot of basic common sense. 7. I try to communicate respect even during our disagreements. 8. If I keep trying to convince my partner, I will eventually win out. 9. I don't reject my spouse's opinions out of hand. 10. My partner is not rational enough to take seriously when we discuss our issues. 11. I believe in lots of give and take in our discussions. 12. I am very persuasive and usually can win arguments with my spouse. 13. I feel I have an important say when we make decisions. 14. My partner usually has good ideas. 15. My partner is basically a great help as a problem solver. 16. I try to listen respectfully even when I disagree. 17. My ideas for solutions are usually much better than my spouse's. 18. I can usually find something to agree with in my partner's position. 19. My partner is usually too emotional. 20. I am the one who needs to make the major decisions in this marriage. Scoring. 1. Give yourself 1 point for each true answer, except for questions 5, 8, 10, 12, 17, 19, and 20. 2. Subtract 1 point for each true answer to questions 5, 8, 10, 12, 17, 19, and 20. 6 or above, this is an area of strength in your marriage. You willingly cede power to your spouse, a hallmark of an emotionally intelligent marriage. Below 6, your marriage could stand some improvement in this area. You are having some difficulty accepting influence from your spouse, which can cause a marriage to become dangerously unstable. The first step in righting the situation is to understand just what it means to accept influence. Replay this chapter if you're still unclear about why it is so essential to share power with your partner. Then the following exercises will show you how to do so. Exercise 1, yield to win. What follows is a series of common situations faced by couples I've studied. Try to visualize these scenes as if you and your wife were the ones having this conflict. Wives who are doing this exercise should flip the genders accordingly. The more vividly you put yourself into each situation, the more effective the exercise will be. No matter how negative you envision your partner is sounding in these scenarios, try to think of the negativity as her way of emphasizing how important this issue is, not as an attack on you. In other words, try to respond to the message, not to your partner's tone of voice. Assume that within that message is a reasonable request with which you could easily agree. In your notebook, describe that reasonable request in a sentence. In some of these scenarios, the demand is implied rather than directly spoken. Then write down what you could say to express your cooperation. There are no right answers to these exercises, but you'll hear examples of effective responses to each of these scenarios in a few minutes. Example: when you come home tired from work, you like to eat dinner and then watch TV. But your wife, who works at home all day, wants to go out. One night she gets very angry and claims that you are inconsiderate of her need to escape from the house. You say that you are just too tired to do anything at night. She yells, "Well, what about me? I will go crazy if I can't get out and have contact with other people." Reasonable part of wife's request: to get out of the house. You say, "I'm sorry you're going so stir-crazy. What if we have a relaxing dinner at home so I can rest and then go out for dessert?" 1. You and your wife have not been getting along lately. Part of the problem is that you think she spends way too much money. Now she's insisting that you undergo expensive marital counseling. You point out that there is simply no money to pay for that until expenses are cut somewhere else. Your wife says, "I disagree. We can't afford not to get counseling. It's like borrowing for a needed vacation. We've got to do it." Reasonable part of wife's request? You say, 2. Since your wife is not working, you've asked that she clean the house and have dinner on the table by the time you come home. Tonight you walk in to find that the laundry isn't folded and dinner isn't made. You complain and she says, "You never notice how much I have done during the day. You just don't appreciate how much work it takes to keep the house going." Reasonable part of wife's request? You say, 3. You've gone down to the local bar with a few friends to have a couple of beers. You and your wife have argued frequently about your going out drinking too often. Tonight, she keeps calling you at the bar to say that if you don't come home right now, she's going to come get you. When you finally walk in the door, she is crying. "Instead of spending all your free time with your buddies at the bar, why don't you ever take me dancing?" Reasonable part of wife's request? You say, 4. It's a Saturday afternoon, and your wife has been cleaning and telling you about some repairs the house needs. You feel that she is not willing to make the financial sacrifices in other areas so that you can afford these repairs. She says, "You just don't think that what I want is important. You'll find money for things if you want them." Reasonable part of wife's request? You say, 5. For the past few days, your wife has been complaining about your not being very affectionate and considerate when you have sex with her. Tonight after sex, your wife tells you she feels dissatisfied and wants you to touch her more. You tell her that you're not used to doing things that way. She says, "I understand how you feel, but we've got to learn how to turn each other on more. I'll try to help you." Reasonable part of wife's request? You say, 6. When you come home from work, the first thing you like to do is get comfortable, have a drink, read the paper, and take off your shoes and socks. Sometimes you make a bit of a mess in the living room, but you usually clean it up after dinner when you have more energy. One night, when you haven't cleaned up, your wife says, "It really makes me mad the way you leave your stuff around. I'm tired too, and I wish I didn't have to pick up after you. Why can't you clean up before dinner?" Reasonable part of wife's request? You say, 7. Money has been tight lately, so you've come up with a system in which you and your wife discuss every purchase beforehand. Tonight you come home, and she announces she's bought new bulbs to replace the outside lights, which just blew. She says she bought them without consulting you because she feels the bulbs are absolutely necessary. She doesn't feel safe at night unless the lights are on. You tell her they may be necessary, but you can't afford them. She says, "We need to have them whether we can afford them or not." Reasonable part of wife's request? You say, 8. You decide to surprise your wife by buying a new car. As soon as she sees it, she gets very upset. She says, "That's terrible. I'll never ride in it. Take it back." Reasonable part of wife's request? You say, 9. You've just come home from work feeling tired, and you still have to run to the hardware store. Your wife, who stays home to raise the kids, says that she has just had a terrible day with them. She asks you to take them with you to the store so she can have some time alone. Reasonable part of wife's request? You say, 10. You like to stay up late and work or watch TV. Your wife likes to go to sleep by 11. One night around 10:30, she comes into the den while you're watching TV and asks you to come to bed. She says that it bothers her that you don't come to bed until after she's asleep because she'd like to have sex more often. Reasonable part of wife's request? You say, sample answers. 1. Reasonable part of wife's request. Your marriage does need help. You say, "I agree that improving our marriage is very important. Maybe counseling is the answer. Let's think about how we can cut down somewhere else so we can afford it. Then I won't be so worried about the money." 2. Reasonable part of wife's request, to feel appreciated for the work she does around the house. You say, "I'm sorry. You're right, I haven't noticed. Let's start over again. Help me to appreciate what has been done. Then maybe I can also pitch in and fold some of this laundry. You've been doing a lot lately. Maybe tonight we should go out to dinner. 3. Reasonable part of wife's request, to spend more of your free time with